Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's midday at the movies. A recent column by Anne Hornaday in the Washington Post was headlined "In Praise of the Messy, Misunderstood Masterpiece and In Search of the Next One." Are studios too cautious and risk-averse, and is their reluctance to take chances premised in something more than fear of financial failure? Anne Hornaday and Maryland Film Festival founder Jed Dietz join me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of Tiger Style at the Olney Theater Center. I'm Tom Hall. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's true. Your dreams have been realized. Today, it's midday at the movies here on WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Anne Hornaday is here. She's the film critic for The Washington Post and the author of the huge best-selling
It gets bigger and bigger every time
it's
I show
gigantic.
Up here.
Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, known in the literary business as the Harry Potter of nonfiction.
Which were true?
I mean, my guess, I haven't checked Google in lately, but my guess is when it comes to the all-time best-selling books of all time, Anne, it's the Bible,
okay.
It's Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
It's your book,
okay.
And then probably something by Marianne Williamson.
All right,
I haven't looked recently, but that's my guess. So don't take my word for it.
I will take your word for it.
Exactly. Jed Dietz is here as well.
You might be wrong on a couple of those.
Maybe one or two, you know, out of 2 out of 4, who knows. Marianne Williamson is probably a fairly good guess. But Jed Dietz is here as well. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, a rat and rodent infested festival that no human being would ever go.
And rat film
infested.
That's right.
He even shows movies about rats at the film festival, just playing right into the narrative of our president. By the way, speaking of that, did you guys watch the debates? What'd you think?
I tune in and out. That format stresses me out so much that I can't sustain. It's such a, you know, I have to give a plug for my colleague Hank Stuver, who wrote a wonderful critic's notebook today about just the wrongness of CNN's staging and production of this thing.
Well, and Kimmel said a wonderful thing. He said, anybody who's been watching reality television, starting with Survivor, over the last 10 or 12 years, knows that you have to form teams. This is not the way to go from 20 to 2 or 3. You have to have teams. You have to have tasks on the island.
Tiki torches, my God, man.
He's telling jokes, of course, but he's sort of right, you know, and this is the most awkward setup. And it's pretending to be a debate with 10 people on every stage.
So is it a CNN problem or a DNC problem, Democratic National Committee?
I think both.
Because in a lot of ways, I thought the two highlights of this week, Tuesday and Wednesday, were Tom Perez's peroration before the debate started. He was incredible, making the case for the Democratic agenda, and he was very powerful. But they have 20 people. I mean, how else would you do it? I mean, at some point, the field is going to be culled. But I'm somewhat sympathetic to CNN is a different issue than the DNC. But the DNC allowing or sanctioning all 20, you got to divide it up. And how do you do that?
But if they're doing it over two nights, and Hank had this idea, why not make it 3 or 4? You know, make the group smaller. You know, this you're not getting anything done because by the time somebody is developing an idea, they're calling time on them, and there's just no room or time.
What did you think? I mean, Megan Garber has a good piece about this in The Atlantic as well. What did you think about the thrust of the CNN panel's questions? Because she makes the point that they didn't really ask specifically, you know, what's your stance on health care, on immigration, et cetera. But they said, what do you think of this other candidate's stance?
Exactly. They were stirring the pot
to create conflict. I did hear Gloria Borger on CNN say in one of these preamble shows that, debates are about friction and moments. Martin O'Malley was on yesterday, and I asked him about, because he's got experience.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been on that stage. I said, for you, when you prep for these things, is it really about friction? And are you looking for that? Are you looking to, the knockout punch? I mean, and the way CNN, just the the music,
the
voiceover,
lighting,
you know.
It, all of it.
And now a boxing match between 10 people who are running for president of the United States. And then we see these somber photographs of each of the people running. I mean, just the way it's played up.
What did he say to that, by the way, since I wasn't...
said, you know, of course he said that it's not what he goes into trying to do, but he's happy if it works out that way. So if there is a viral moment, you know, it obviously plays to his advantage.
I do think one of the things that's happening, even in this very awkward format, is I'm hearing from people I've never heard of before, Andrew Yang and Inslee.
I mean,
even some established political figures that Mike Bennett, I've never heard Inslee or Bennett talk before. And seeing public servants of that quality committed to certain kinds of issues, Yang, you know, being entrepreneurial, and Inslee very much about the environment and climate change. I just think even in this format, you get little bursts of sort of new ideas and fresh ideas, and it seems like it gets out a little bit of this vitriol stuff that we've been going through under this presidency. And I think that there are little glimmers of hope and all of that.
I think they're difficult decisions. I mean, we can complain about the format, but I just, at least for me, I don't know how I would have changed it other than I would have asked questions in a different way.
Exactly.
Questions,
but that's big, though, Tom. I mean, that's actually a big format.
And all that stuff and the bagpipes or whatever they were doing in the beginning was just sort of silly. But did you think it was a notch or two down from the way MSNBC handled the first round of debates?
I don't even think I watched those because I was at screening or something, so I'll opt out of this.
It's interesting. Joe McGinnis, a long time ago, great chronicler of politics for a long time in the 60s and 70s, one of his ideas was always, once you're down to the two candidates, when you're down to the two national party candidates, put them in a room, lock the door, turn a camera on, and 60 minutes later, open the door
again.
Let
them talk. Yeah.
And just see where they go, you know, and see what they want to talk about, see how much they challenge each other, see how much depth they can get in. And I have no idea whether that would work, but
My own personal opinion, and Linnell and I both agreed on this, that Tuesday night was much more substantive and productive than Wednesday night. And that's just because of the particular mix of people, I guess, and the way.
I don't think
the questions were all that much different on Tuesday than they were on Wednesday.
Well, you didn't have a leader. And, you know, when you have a leader, which Biden is right now by substantial amounts, then people have got to take shots at him. I mean, that's sort of a 101
course.
Well,
that's the question. Do they got to take shots? Well, I mean, is there a way of running for president without just, you know, diminishing somebody else? Is it a zero-sum game? You got to wipe somebody else out in order to raise yourself up. It is messy. But speaking of messy, because we do get to get to the subject du jour here, here's a column that Ann wrote the other day in the Post in praise of the messy, misunderstood masterpiece and in search of the next one. I really enjoyed this column a lot, Ann.
We will
put a link to it on our website. But the thrust of your argument is that it's tough for these filmmakers to screw up, you know, to try outrageous things and screw up because the screw up margins are just so much tighter than, are they tighter than they used to be? Has it gotten a lot worse?
Well, I'd love to hear what Jed has to say because you're more, I think, connected to the producing end of things. But this was inspired by a reflection on the fact that this is the 40th anniversary of Apocalypse Now, you know, which was a famous mess. You know, the production was a mess. And
it was actually several times a mess.
Exactly. It was messy on all sorts of levels. And it turned into this kind of visionary, hallucinatory, I think, mess, you know, inarguably a masterpiece, which at the time was accepted as such then. I mean, it was very well received. So it wasn't necessarily misunderstood when it first came out. But it kind of jogged my, you know, thinking about those sorts of movies that are just these kind of go for broke, you know, swing for the fences, give it all you got. And I mean, shortly after Apocalypse came out, then you have Heaven's Gate, which is probably the text of this kind of thing, you know, where an auteur filmmaker just puts his all into something and it's indulgent and it's sprawling and it's unfocused. And then they go to movie jail for X number of years. And then
that's Michael Cimino, right?
Cimino, exactly.
Cimino. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, and Elaine May got dinged for Ishtar. I mean, there are these famous kind of misfires, many of which in further years and decades to come are then reclaimed, you know, and reassessed and thought and well thought of. But I was thinking about our current time in the movie business. It's Disney's taking over everything. It's a Disney-fied business. It was before, but now it's literally Disney-fied. And Netflix, you know, streaming, and there are all these changes happening that are changing the way filmmakers approach their work. And I think a lot of that auteurist energy is now going towards show running. You know, like now we're seeing auteurs channeling their genius through series, exactly, yeah. And streaming series. So that's kind of what inspired this.
And Jeb, before we go to you, listeners, we'd love to have you guys weigh in as well. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Hi, everybody on Facebook. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. What are the masterpieces you've seen that you think are a little messy? A lot of people are using the term mess to describe Quentin Tarantino's new movie, which I do want to argue about. But what do you think? I mean, is it just financial? Is it just that the producers of these studios are just terrified of losing money?
Yes, I think they are terrified of losing money from the business side, and they try to often will overthink and try to overmanage, because you really, it's an art form. I mean, that is really what you're betting on.
Yeah, picking the scripts.
Yeah, yeah. But I would argue Tarantino's whole career is, messy masterpieces, depending on which one you like the best and all that stuff. We'll get into it. I like this one, but not everybody
does.
New
one's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would say you could go through his whole oeuvre. I mean, he did this 70mm, The Hateful Eight movie that I loved, but, you know, it was shown with an intermission. It was, you know, it was a total swing for the fences from presentational standpoint, mm-hmm. and I would say even thematically, and people love it and hate it. And,
you know, Spike Lee, I think also you could argue, he's made a whole career of these really... they're just deeply personal. They've both created their own cinematic language, and they are going to do what they're going to do. And they have the name, you know. And in Tarantino's case, a big studio like Sony is going to bet on that because of he's his own brand now, and they can kind of guarantee a certain audience that's always going to show up for a Tarantino film. And it doesn't hurt that Sony's run by Tom Rothman, Baltimore's own, a cinephile to his toes, you know, who loves movies.
Right.
And we're so lucky that one of our remaining big studios in Hollywood is run by someone who understands and actually loves cinema.
Yeah, I mean, he started being a lawyer for Jim Jarmusch, you know?
Let's listen to a little clip from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is a scene in which the stunt director, a guy named Randy, who's played by Kurt Russell, comes by and talks to Rick Dalton, who is the main protagonist, one of the two main protagonists. He's played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And Randy is telling Rick that he doesn't want to work with Rick's stunt double, Cliff Booth, who's played by Brad Pitt. So this is a star-studded affair here, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Just put him in the wardrobe, all right? What's it going to hurt? Then if you need him, you got him, all right?
Hey, man. And I can't afford to hire a bunch of guys that smoke cigarettes and sit around talking to each other all day on the chance that I might use them.
I got a 4-man team here, Rick. If I need more than that, I got to get it approved. And, you know, I got to look after my dudes.
Hey, and if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for me.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a... Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rick?
Yeah.
I don't dig him. And I don't dig the vibe he brings on a set.
And I must say, I do not dig this movie in any way, shape, or form. It seemed completely disjointed. A series of scenes that Mr. Tarantino was clearly enamored of. That one being one of them. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on and on. This is an almost 3-hour movie. What am I not getting? Mr. Tarantino's a genius from what I'm told. And and Linnell loved it, by the way. She just adored it. I thought it was awful. I had steam coming in my ears walking out of the Parkway Theater. Yeah. So what am I missing here, Jed? You like this movie.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. And it surprised me a little bit just because I know you've had a whole career interested in working artists. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, and I think this is a great love note to actors, not stars, actors in movie and television of a certain era when television and movies were actually two very separate things. And the life they led, the craft of it, the work of it, that scene you just played, I think, is part, you know, trying to get his buddy, who's now helping take care of him, basically, on set for this movie. That happens a lot.
Yeah, and friends help friends get jobs. Yep. You know, they know the director and music. That happens all the time. You know, the soprano gets hired, and then, you know, her husband, the tenor, gets hired too, magically. I mean, that happens all
the
time.
And it's a world we're not told at all about. You know, we're told about the star's life, and, you know, those stories are managed, and so-and-so angry with somebody, or are they going to raise some money together or whatever.
So this is like a realistic look behind the camera?
Yeah, and I think from a guy who loves the minutia and knows how to portray it in a way that is quite different than anybody else, and to me, it was just totally enchanting.
Well,
he's
a person who needs to be taken seriously. It's at the Parkway and the Senator. But what's your take on this movie?
Well, I was mixed. You know, I mean, I think by now, as we were saying earlier, Tarantino has his language. I think he's a deeply fetishistic filmmaker, and if his fetishes align with yours, you'll be very happy at this movie. But then if they don't, you'll be incredibly bored. And I think it's both. I mean, I think it's stunning. It's exquisite looking. I mean, it was shot by Robert Richardson. It's set in 1969, so it's very redolent of that time and era in Hollywood and LA, and it's delicious from that standpoint as just a period piece and a Valentine to that era. And I thought
the set was incredible.
Yeah, it's just
gorgeous
to watch.
You know, 1969 LA. Not that I was in LA in 1969, but it's gorgeous.
It is beautiful.
I was 14 years old in 1969, and so I was at the height of my listening to pop music phase.
Right.
You know,
right.
I played these songs in bars. I played in bands.
Right.
I played folk festivals and stuff. And so I was very keyed into the music.
Yeah.
And that was all beautiful. I mean, as a film, it's the acting.
It's a sensory experience.
The acting is terrific.
It's wonderful.
Really, I can't complain almost about any element, and I hated the movie.
But structurally, I agree with you. I do think it's too long, and I do think it's too indulgent. And we, you know, the whole kind of the unspoken bookend is the Manson murders, and how he handles that. You know, I don't want to spoil anything, but it plays into this kind of. This fantasy that he sets up, that I think it's deeply moving for him. It's very meaningful for him. But at the end of the day, I just don't think it means as much as to me as it did to him. You know, it's going to be very subjective about how emotionally connected you are to this story. And for me, I just got off the train.
Ann Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival. Before we take a quick break, we'd like to thank one of our lunch sponsors, Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find them online at dangerouspiesbalt.com. You can find us online in 90 seconds. You can also find us back on the radio when we come back for a break. We're going to talk about The Lion King, another incredible phenomenon. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @midday WIPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWIPR, and you can catch us on Facebook. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the Midday News Wrap, 20 of them, 20 Democratic presidential candidates had their second round of televised debates this week in Detroit. The Wall Street Journal's national political reporter Julie Bykowitz and NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez will join me with analysis and insight into the debates and the other news of the week. Plus, we're going to talk to the curators of a new photo exhibition at the Maryland Historical Society called Reflections, A Brief History of Looking at Ourselves. Joe Trapea and Professor Elena Volkova of Stevenson University will be here tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the August edition of Midday at the Movies with our good buddies Ann Hornaday of The Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. We'd love to hear from you. What did you think of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and have you seen The Lion King? If you have, you are not alone. I'm told several other people have as well. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR, and we're also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jed, you had another comment about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, I was just going to build off of something Ann was saying, which I think the inflection point that he's showing in 1969 in Hollywood, this total innocence and, you know, everybody's fine, we're all in it together, is combined with this impending, the Manson family and the damage they're about to do. And I think, I thought that totally worked, that there's this sort of, you know, like the Spahn Ranch scene in the movie that with Brad Pitt doing such a great job and Lena Dunham, a bunch of people doing a great job in that scene. The creepiness of that was ladled in a really beautiful way.
The scenes were lovely. They just were, they were not stitched together.
And there were too many of them.
There was a whole bunch of them, But, you know, and given what the country, you know, went through in 1968, one of the most tumultuous years in the history of the Republic.
That's a very good point.
None of which was alluded to.
Exactly. That, and that, I didn't put, I was very aware of that, too. It's not, you know, this is about his childhood, and it's about the loss of his childhood innocence, and it's deeply personal to him. But it's a fable, it's a fairy tale, which is why it's called Once Upon a Time.
Right.
And I get that, and I don't want to, you know, I don't, if that's how he feels, that's how he feels. I just don't relate to it at all. I mean, I don't buy the innocence because I don't think it's true. You know, I think there was much more paranoia abroad in the land at that time that he's just not aware of or not addressing. And I don't understand, and I had the same problem with Inglourious Basterds. You know, it's just like this thing that he does, this particular kind of revisionism.
That's it. And as I recall,
it doesn't have any moral heft to me. It's meaningless to me.
As I recall, somebody even saying, paranoia strikes deep
into
your heart, it will creep. All right, got to talk about The Lion King, because it's about lions and royalty. I mean, so this is like Meghan Markle, and then, I mean, I don't know.
She went to the premiere, apparently.
Did she?
Good
for her.
So.
Well, she wasn't alone. So, I mean, I love the Elton John music for The Lion King. I never saw Julie Taymor's production of it in
New York. Oh, you need to just stop everything, and we have to go right now to wherever it's playing.
Do we? Because it's
still
good.
On Broadway.
Oh,
yeah.
It is. I saw it at the Hippodrome here, and it's just magnificent.
Yeah.
You'll love it.
That's what
you
I'm
will
told.
See it, and
that's
you will love it.
Okay, I'm sure I will. I did see the movie, the animated movie, because it came out at a time where our daughter was of that age, and so I saw it, I don't know, 700-800 times, and loved it every time.
Yeah.
But evidently the tech of this, the CGI, is that what that's called, where they create things that really look like real lions
Incredible.
Who are talking?
It's incredible. I mean, it really
is. So this is an advance. This is a step forward for movie making.
I would say so. Mm-hmm. I would say so. And of course, no matter how much tech you bring, it comes down to that story and those characters. And they follow that original very, almost beat for beat. There's a few extra songs in this one. But it for all intents and purposes, this looks like a live action film. You know, I mean, they have captured images in such a way as to make them hyper photorealistic. We were talking last month about, like, we almost need a new word for this now, because it's just somewhere in between animation and realism or live action. And I thought it worked beautifully well. I mean, it's gotten dinged in some quarters for being too uncanny and getting into Uncanny Valley, but I was completely immersed, and I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And I thought it brought enough novelty to that original story that, you know, it's a respectable a remake.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked with a live leopard one time at the Baltimore Opera Company.
Ooh.
Aprile Milo, famous soprano. We were doing an Aida, and this incredibly drugged up animal who was staying at the Peabody Court Hotel with its trainer shows up to the dress rehearsal and sits next to Aprile and moves at one point, like, you know, just raises his head. And Aprile made a beeline off of the stage so fast, your heart's, and we all, like, left the building. Elvis had left the, I mean, we did not want to be backstage at the Lyric Theater with a leopard whose drugs were...
Who's, like, coming off his high.
Yeah, he's coming off his high.
He's coming down.
So I'm glad they did the CGI for the sake of the actors.
And to that point, and I'm glad they did it for the sake of the animals, because I really am more and more bugged when people use animals for anything. You know, it's just like, leave them alone. Don't just please. And so for that, you know, like, I think this production got an award from PETA, you know, because no animal, literally, no animals were harmed, you know, and it's wonderful.
But this really has just sort of moved the needle on what's possible.
It's hard to imagine how much it's moved the needle. As sweeping and as epic as the initial animation was and as the stage show is, which I think to this day is still the biggest money-making piece of entertainment ever, the stage show that Julie Taymor did and is playing in 80 countries as we speak, probably around the world. This is even bigger. I mean, it really, when this thing hits the screen, it is just awesome. And I mean, I don't even know what more to say about it. I think the story, as Anne said, is proven. It is interesting that with a little bit of quibbling from critics and why did you do this, didn't need to be remade, blah, blah, blah. And
because it's evidently sort of shot for shot the same thing as the
cartoon.
It's pretty
close.
Yes,
right?
It is.
It's pretty close. There are a couple, like Anne said, there are a couple new songs. There's, you know, you've got a couple other star, Beyonce's voice is one of the animals and that kind of stuff.
And they've tweaked her character a little bit. They've given her a little, a feminist, you know, some more.
Yep.
Hey, look, you get Beyonce in a movie. You're gonna write to her.
There's an information.
I would write her. I would write to her under any circumstances. I love her. She's great.
But it's just the sweep of the African plain, the sense of what this means to us on this planet to have these animals and have this land is it just sweeps over you in a way that you just couldn't do with the animation. And I don't know where this art form is going, this new technology, but. This is just, it's awesome.
And
that's
financially,
all I can tell you.
It's just blown up everything. Right?
So it's opening weekend. It alone did more business than all the movies in this weekend last year.
Mm. Wow.
Just to give you
that's
I mean,
on,
it's
that's
huge.
On par with Anne Hornaday's book.
Close.
That's incredible.
Close.
I mean, that's incredible. All right. And listeners, if you have seen this thing, we'd love to hear what you think about it. I had blood drawn the day that Lion King opened, and the phlebotomist was like giddy. She couldn't work because she was going to see Lion King that night with her whole family and stuff.
It.
And that's all we talked about the entire time that
really?
She drained my innards. It was great. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at Midday WIPR, and you can ping us on the WIPR Facebook page. So I want to talk about a movie I haven't seen, but I'm going to see, I think, tomorrow, The Farewell.
Ooh. Oh, excellent. That's a great choice.
Everyone says it's a great choice. So Anne Hornaday, why is it a great choice?
I think you shall enjoy it. This is a wonderful movie directed by Lulu Wong, written and directed by Lulu Wong. If people...
Charles Theater, by the way, here in Baltimore.
The wonderful Charles. I'm sure lots of your listeners are fans of This American Life. This is a movie that started as a This American Life episode where she recounted a true story in her family's past where they're, you know, she's from China. And her beloved grandmother received a poor diagnosis with a very poor prognosis. And rather than tell her, the family rallied around, kept it from her, thinking that'll just give her no hope and she'll die. So rather than tell her she was going to die, they these young people were going to get married anyway, but they rushed the wedding to give her something to do and give people an excuse to get together. And so this is a movie version of that with Awkwafina, who we think of, or I think of, as a comic actress. She was wonderful in Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8. She's a comedian, but it's a really wonderful performance, dramatic and comedic. This family story that even though it's deeply specific to the Chinese people and culture, it's absolutely universal in terms of family dynamics and love. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful film.
Yeah.
So the Awkwafina character is Asian American, brought up in America, and is told by her parents not to go back for this wedding, the fake wedding, but tribute for the grandmother, because she'll be too emotional. They just
She'll blow their cover.
Exactly, and therefore start to cry, and therefore the grandmother, the whole purpose will be blown. She goes on her own anyway. She just can't. She listens to them. She thinks they might be right, but she can't stay away. So the whole thing. It bookends in New York, but it basically the whole thing takes place in China. I think actually Lulu Wang's grandmother's hometown.
Absolutely.
And
yes,
Lulu Wang, Awkwafina, actually, I just learned, was actually brought up by her grandmother. Her mother died when she was 4 years old, and her grandmother to this day is like her mentor and guide. And Awkwafina told Lulu, she said, I'm a comedian. I don't think I can cry. If if somebody says cry on camera, I'm not an actor. I'm not a trained actor. She said the minute she touched down in China, she started crying. She said she didn't
stop. Kept crying through the whole shoot.
Perfect. Yeah,
good for her.
It's wonderful.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. There's another movie I want to talk to you about I have actually seen it.
Oh,
and
what?
As you know,
what?
When I've seen
buried the lead.
More, I know, when I have seen more than one movie, it's a blessed event. So I've now seen two. I've seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
And I also saw and loved, so I hope we can argue about this. If you hated it, it would be great. Yesterday.
Oh, of course.
I thought, as much as I despise Mr. Tarantino's latest movie, I mean, the best news of last week, I open up Time magazine and Mr. Tarantino says he's going to make one more movie and then quit. I thought, that's terrific.
It's going to be called To Tom with Love.
I'm in To Tom
everything.
With Love.
One too many, right.
But yesterday, I thought that movie was fantastic in every frame. I loved every second of it.
Right on, brother.
So how about you guys?
Well, I totally agree. It's a simple, almost ridiculous concept, which is that the Beatle music, through an event, sort of unexplained event, you see it, but no details given, the world wipes out memory of the Beatles and the songs and everything else. You Google Beatles and you see bugs and stuff, they just don't exist anymore. And this, except for one guy who happens to be a struggling musician in England, and he discovers this by playing Yesterday for his buddies, and they all think, hey, that's good.
The line is, it's not Coldplay, but it's actually really good.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
There's
even
some
better.
Really funny lines.
And he starts to, quote unquote, build a career off the Beatles songs. He does a lot of work to remember the words and the chords and all that sort of stuff. So you're hearing these things slightly oddly arranged, because he's who he is. He doesn't have the Beatles. Yeah. He's just him. And the path of that, I mean, I totally agree with you on the, first of all, I think it's beautifully done. Danny Boyle, who won an Academy Award for Slumdog Millionaire and is a wonderful stage and film director. Richard Curtis, who wrote Four Weddings and a Funeral, wrote it. So you've got a wonderful team of people. But I think you're right. I think what it does for those songs.
Yeah, that was the thing that really made me literally cry through the whole movie. It elevates the songs,
yes.
The art. I mean, Paul McCartney is an incredible artist, and he's an incredible person. And Lennon, Harrison and Starr, also good musicians. But the concentration for many of us is always on those people. Mm. But their work is the thing that's just incredible, and it elevates the work. I mean, we're talking about with Quentin Tarantino elevating the work of working actors.
Yeah,
this works. It elevates the work of composers who are historically superb.
Yeah.
I mean, Schumann, Schubert, Mozart are going to be in the same league as John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and several others at that era. Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder. These are writers that are just singing. So this elevates the writing. And Yesterday, the song itself has always been. It's always been an attraction to me because it shows what music can do to words. Because, if you're in the eighth grade and Mrs. Perkins says, write a poem, and you come in the next day and say, yesterday, all my troubles were so far away. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. She says, that's a C-, go back to home ec or the shop, right? But you take two notes. Sol, fa, a G natural and F natural. They're next to each other on the piano. It's not complicated. And you say the word. The way you sing the word, the way you say it, and just that little melodic thing. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now I need a place to hide away. It becomes a profound piece of art.
Yeah.
a profound piece of art. And it's the music that does that. It's not the words, which he called scrambled eggs for the first 2 weeks that he had the tune going.
They almost called the script scrambled eggs, by the way.
Yeah.
McCartney suggested scrambled eggs for the name of the movie, and they thought about it.
But I just because it elevates the art, because you know this is 21-year-old kid in Liverpool writing that song, the most recorded song in the history of the universe. Mm. Everything about this movie was great for me. Aww. So yesterday, it was at the Senator when we saw it. I assume it's still there.
And
it is a great place to see it. Before we go, the Parkway Theater has a couple of freebies coming up. There's a free screening of The Sage, which is a movie about Erica Bridgeford, a good friend of our show who comes by every 4 times a year after each of the ceasefire weekends. Yep. So that's tonight, right, Jed?
Yes.
All right. And then there's another one also tonight called The Queen. I don't know anything about that movie. What's that about?
So The Queen is not for free, but is a restoration of a 1967 documentary about this gay contest that it is a pretty famous contest. This restoration is brand new and will run it, I think, at least through the weekend. So.
Yeah,
good. Very well seen.
So two things to say at the Parkway. The Charles Theater has The Farewell, Marianne and Leonard.
Oh, that's another good
both
one.
Both you guys like. This is a documentary about Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Right? He's at the Charles.
And Wonderful. Then one that you saw, Anne, called Sword of Trust.
Oh, right? Yes. Oh. Yes, go see that one too, everybody. That's fun. Mark Maron, another funny, Awkwafina and Mark Maron both this summer are turning in really great performances.
He's a comedian.
Yeah, but in this one, he brings the dramatic game in a big way.
And
it's
directed
a
by the great
movie.
Lynn Shelton.
Indeed.
I mean, just
indeed.
Wonderful.
So next month, September, we're going to now start getting into the Oscar stuff, right? People are going to start throwing movies out there.
I might be joining you from Toronto at that point.
There you go, the Toronto Film Festival. Yeah. That's happened before. All right. Always good to see you. Enjoy the rest of your summer, and we'll see you next month. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Hornaday, a film critic for The Washington Post, and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Coming up after a short break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will join us with her weekly review. We're going to talk about Tiger Style at the Olney Theater Center. But before we go to break, it's our practice each week here on Midday to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We usually share these names on Monday. This week we're doing it today. And we do so to stand in witness to the untimely deaths of the people who have been killed and to remember the victims' families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 196 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, police released the identity of a victim whose death was first reported the week before last. He is Lonnie Edwards. He was 35 years old. And during this past week, police reported 8 people lost their lives to violence in our city. They are Nathaniel Green, age 26, Calvin Carter, age 32, Curtis Cannon, age 29, Brock Burton, age 36, Devon Chavis, age 28, Anton Eastman, age 29, Scott Franklin, age 32, and Carlos Liverpool. He was 15 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.